there are a number of people sat on the floor, one person in fact on a chair, very well prepared, around George Orwell's grave, Eric Arthur Blair's grave, on this today, the 25th of June, his birthday. How old would he have been today? I believe he would have been about 111 years old. I think another anniversary today, this year, the 65th anniversary of the publication of 1984. And as our small group here, consisting of, can you give us your Twitter name?
At Soul Cruiser.
At Edent.
These two people conspiring down here. Twitter name?
At UK Cameraman.
At Tony Gosling.
At Lucid Touchstone.
And me at Documentally. And whilst these people are sat around here talking and discussing, somewhere on the Isle of Jura, currently, I think, parked behind a downed cable and telegraph pole or something, I think it's a power line actually, is Dr. John Perivaralis, who has just sent an encrypted message through an app to me, telling me he's 6 miles away from the cottage where George Orwell wrote 1984. We're wondering whether or not there will be the ability to communicate with him while he is there, but he'll be there for a picnic, as we are here for a picnic, and maybe we can connect the groups together. One year, I hope to also go to George Orwell's cottage. I might have to do the same as John and picnic outside, because I believe it's about 800 a week if you want to rent it. Maybe we can come up with some kind of project. I wonder if there's two new faces this year. One of them is Terence Edent on Twitter, who has popped up with a huge phone. How you doing?
I'm very well, enjoying the sunshine for once.
I really appreciate you coming over, especially as later on today you'll be doing something rather exciting.
I will be jumping out of a hot air balloon. No, just riding up in a hot air balloon. Jumping out for someone else.
Yeah, is someone actually jumping out?
Oh, I hope not. That would be terrifying.
No, if you hit some power lines, you just hold tight.
Right, I will do.
Because not being earthed, it should be all right.
I don't need any more scaring, thank you. I'm terrified enough as it is.
We've had a lot of air activity here. We always do. Regular as clockwork, there's always some massive...
A couple of helicopters flying over.
Helicopters coming over. I'm sure there must be some base nearby. It's absolutely nothing to do with our meeting and the fact we've gone up to DEFCOMs just with Tony Gosling rocking up, who is another new face who also runs, he does an awful lot of stuff. He's a journalist, but he runs Bilderberg.org. There we go.
Bilderberg.org?
Bilderberg.
Oh, right.
Yes, it's completely different.
I was going to say that you want to watch out for those bears. They're planning on taking over the world, I hear.
What brings you here, apart from my invitation?
Well, I've been thinking an awful lot about surveillance, and we recently had the Home Secretary say that there is no pervasive monitoring. There's just monitoring which is done automatically and pervasively. And it got me thinking about if it's just time to give up. I'm quite serious. When we look at, say, Greenpeace or any one of 100 organisations which are fighting for something, whether you believe in it or not, they're infiltrated by the police. We see... quite a lot of stories at the moment where it's alleged that undercover police officers had relationships with people undercover and what can only be, I think, described as rape or sexual assault, and then fathered children and then left, all with the apparent knowledge of their bosses. And at that point you think, well, how can you fight against a surveillance system which is willing to go to that length? I mean, I know you, but I've no real way of knowing whether you're an undercover cop or not. I mean, you've got a beard, that doesn't prove anything. I don't know these other four chaps who are here. They don't know me. There's no way to know that any one of these people isn't an undercover cop reporting on this. Now, why would they care about us? Well, why would they care about animal rights activists or peace protesters or fascists or anti-fascists? Well, evidently they do. Evidently, every message we send can be tracked. And yes, you can make an argument that if they really want to get you, they will, but...
You're making me look suspiciously now at the bin men that are reversing up a very narrow road.
I mean, one can be paranoid. I don't truly think any of you are. As exciting and fun as this is, I don't think it's really, the breeding ground for huge political dissent. But let's suppose that you did want to start up a political organisation. Well, why wouldn't the police infiltrate you to make sure that you're not... an extremist of one flavour or another, and if all your contents are being monitored regardless of your political position, there's literally very little you can do to change the status quo. And that's why I see we're seeing a more entrenched sort of form of, I don't want to get into isms, but the world isn't changing as quickly as I think some people would like in a positive direction, whereas it's self-evidently becoming more and more. And I think the world is more for powerful people now than it has been, and however you define power, whether it's money or political connections. And so that's the way they've organised the world, and they've also organised it so it is structurally impossible to have dissent of any sort. You know, if you look at the Labour Party, then they're no longer a working class party. That's obvious. The only way they can get elected, they believe, is to continue the sort of neoliberal capitalist attitude, which is, you know, very contrary to what they were set up to do. So when you've got three political parties who are broadly the same, we've got a surprise Green Party MP, which is wonderful. I think Caroline Lucas is brilliant, but who doesn't believe that the Green Party isn't now riddled with police and security services and everyone tracking what they're doing? They can't foment any real dissent because that won't be allowed. So this is a long and rambly way of just saying, I think it's time to give up. I think we should just go back, sit on our haunches, enjoy, you know, good food and good wine, and get on with our lives, and just say, well, that's it, the game is rigged, there's no point trying to change the rules.
Tony, I've got to bring Tony into this conversation, because you mentioned paranoia, and if anybody's going to make you paranoid...
Well, I mean, there are legitimate reasons to be paranoid, and, you know, when you read your history books, you know, it's quite obvious that bad things happen to good people, and that, you know, police infiltrate benign organisations.
Have children with...
Yeah, have children.
We've just had a conversation along the lines of how deep the surveillance can go, and Terence has just suggested, well, maybe it's time just to give up. Enjoy your food and
what can we do against it? I don't know. That's what I'm saying.
I think we put the people who've been putting people under surveillance without going to courts to get warrants, we put them in jail.
How? Who's going to arrest them?
Well, who knows? Maybe the police will. We had the Police Federation on the radio in Bristol recently saying we need more arrests of some of these top people, including bankers. That was the Police Federation themselves. Mm. I think there's an increasing awareness that what's been going on at the top within the signals intelligence community, if you want to call them a community, is criminal. And ultimately, you know, how far down do they want that lack of rule of law to go?
I mean, I disagree. I don't think it is criminal. I think it's wrong. I think it's immoral. But, you know, my reading of Ripper and the other things like that is, no, the Labour Party rigged the law. So, yes, they can do that. Now, whether it's right or wrong, I desperately think it's wrong.
Let's see it go to court, at least.
You don't think it could? Well, I think if Rebecca Brooks can feign ignorance that there was phone hacking going on my newspaper. Well, I'm shocked to discover.
Well, don't forget the tears. You've got to get some tears.
And I'm sure she's been found innocent. So let's assume.
But what you're saying is an apathy charter, isn't it? Really,
I think it's less than apathy. I think it's time to accept. I don't think it's apathy. Is saying I don't care. I'm saying we should care, but we should accept it.
You're accepting a police state, then, aren't you?
Totalitarianism.
Yeah.
Is it?
No, it's not. But what realistically can we do? You and I cannot. We could form a conspiracy, just you and me.
Citizens' arrest? With a decent lawyer?
It's happened with Blair. He's not gone down for it. He's been four or five citizens' arrests.
Mr. Blair may have not gone down into jail, but he's certainly gone down to the bottom in stakes of any kind of credibility.
I'm sure he weeps into his piles of money every single night. With his, you know, his son standing for election somewhere, I'm sure that will be of cold comfort to him. But no, what I'm saying is that, let's say that I trust you, okay? I don't know that you're not a policeman, but let's assume that I trust you. So you and I can form a conspiracy, and we're going to arrest Blair or arrest
Cameron.
It's
not a conspiracy, no.
All right.
We'll uphold the law, which is what the system is refusing to do.
But, you know, in order to gain any meaningful traction, we're going to need more than two of us, aren't we? I mean, just you know, we will need a lawyer. We will need, you know, people to do the arresting. Once you start adding people, that web of trust becomes thinner and thinner until it is inevitable that at the moment that you start to get any traction, you'll attract the attention of them.
But isn't that the point? That what you're talking about here really is direct action in terms of taking action against criminals.
But I'm saying that the direct
action... Because the police want to. A lot of them do, but they just can't.
Well, I think there's enough of them who don't want to that will ensure that any direct action will fizzle out, or... You know, We'll all of a sudden go to arrest Blair, for example. I don't want to arrest you, Mr. Blair, just so we're interested.
I do, by the way.
You're a very bad man. But what I'm saying is, we'll go off to arrest him, and hey, presto, one of the people who's helping us load our van has loaded up a kilo of heroin into it. You know, now all of a sudden evil drug traffickers try to kidnap XPM.
But with your approach, you would never take any action to do anything.
I don't think we can.
Yes, we can. Of course
hang on, let me step in here. So we've got Terence with Resistance is Futile. What's yours?
Resistance is Necessary.
And so what... Are you playing the long game, as in, Terence, Resistance is Futile, we're pulling on the towel, someone else is pulling on the towel, for a moment you're going to let go and give them a false sense of security as they hit the deck and go, right, it's all ours. And then when totalitarian kicks in...
I'm hoping to climb to the top by the rules as much as I can, I think that...
And become king of totalitarianism.
Well, I don't think I'll be king, but, you know, I'd rather be a loyal lieutenant in... No, I wouldn't. I mean, obviously, that's crazy. But I'm just saying is that... Why wouldn't you?
Just gave yourself away there. Yeah.
Loyal lieutenant.
I trusted this
beard. Lieutenant. What am I saying? That's very American. But no, I think for most people, and it does make me feel this way, is that I do think resistance is futile because you couldn't get any more than... You know, a couple of rungs up the ladder.
You say resistance is futile. I say resistance is fun. It's actually a brilliant way of coming together and showing that people are prepared.
Is this a game?
It's not a game.
When has it changed anything?
It's deadly serious, but it can also. I
love it. You know,
resistance
is
the only thing I think someone said that has ever changed anything.
Where is the underdog fought and won?
Well, it's not. I can't think of anything recently where in this country. No,
I mean,
for example,
the Chartists is a good example. I mean,
okay, that's 500
this
years
is actually
ago.
The most powerful thing is ideas. The Chartists had ideas which at the time they didn't materialise for them, but then they rolled out over the previous decades.
The idea of resistance
is absolutely key and crucial, that we are not simply just going to go along with the system. And if you lose that, you lose everything.
But when... So the Chartists, a few hundred years ago, you've got the Diggers and the Movers and all these people. Yeah. Maybe I'm thinking of crap 80s
Removal
bands,
Men.
The Removal Men, yeah. Yeah. When are the Removal Men? What have the Removal Men ever done for... I'm saying recently...
The Levellers,
you know,
maybe, yeah.
Levellers, that's what I'm thinking of. Is, you know, I've been on student demos, you know, against... nuclear installations, against tuition fees, the Iraq war. You know, we had a million people, you know, marching on London. Didn't happen. We have every student in the country saying tuition fees like that.
Are you looking for two million at least?
Pick a number. It's, you know, it's a large, large amount.
You've just doubled the uselessness of that.
Let's say the Countryside Alliance, who I don't agree with, but they, you know, got together a good chunk of people who marched down and said, you know, we want fox hunting. That's something I disagree with, but they had a load of people. That still hasn't changed. I can't think of any time in my lifetime, with the exception of the poll tax, where something has been rolled back.
I'm sorry, you got that wrong, because the poll tax was never gotten rid of. What we've got is this: is the
so you're agreeing
exactly
with,
the same.
You're agreeing with me.
I am. In that case, yeah.
So when has in the last? I'm 35 years. Let's say 40. You know.
Okay, I'm 52.
When in your lifetime has popular protest and popular resistance changed anything?
I think, for example, with the Iraq business, the massive demonstrations changed massively the perception in the country about whether we have any faith in democracy. This is really important. If democracy has been undermined, then the first way to change things is to make sure people are aware of that. Democracy has been undermined, and now we are aware of it. At least that there is some kind of movement within society to change things now. And there are this. I mean, we've got people here today talking about things like monetary reform. People are looking at the way through this. So when the crash hits us, we won't be saying, "Oh my God, what do we do?" We're going to say, "Ah, oh, there's the guy that told us what to do."
We have another voice joining us.
Yeah, my name's Paul Martin. I'm at UK Cameraman on Twitter.
It's just so the police know who you are.
Yeah, I know. I swear to God we're being watched here every year. But anyway, I was just earwigging on that. And what I wanted to say was, you know, when was the last time anything changed by mass protest? It's the same with doing the news. I read a book, it's called The News, A User's Manual, and I can't for the life of me remember who it was that wrote it, but I wrote a blog post on it. And he basically said the last big news in this country was the English Civil War. The rest of it is all same, just different players, different time.
Why was the Civil War any different to
because that changed our country irrevocably from what it was to what it became.
Well, that's not necessarily irrevocable.
Alain de Botton, the News A User's Manual. I wrote a blog post on it, and it's a really, really interesting book. Please go and read it. It will change the way you look at news.
Are you saying it's forever. A distraction? You are working as a TV cameraman in a distraction mechanism.
No, because no.
That was a pained.
It was.
What does Tony think?
It was.
Look, I've got to come in here because having worked in a very busy newsroom in central London, yes, I would say 90% of what you say is absolutely true. Mm. But we would every once a week, as on the news desk, get a real story.
Yes.
Usually, it was a listener phoning in. Someone had come through, maybe Tommy Vance or Johnny Walker programmes, which had done, they would do quite a lot of current affairs.
Can I just say, it's been the absolute quietest day I've ever experienced here in this graveyard.
Until I press record
and it's like every single piece of traffic known to humanity.
And this is a terrible thing to say, but when the stock exchange bomb happened, right, that was real news.
Yes,
suddenly
yes,
the
course,
journalists
those,
are right, yeah. Here's some real news. Let's send four people out to the actual location. Maybe one by tube, one on a motorbike, see who gets there first. We've got some real news. It's not a press release. Mm-hmm. It's not some sort of corporate announcement, some celebrity endorsing something, coming in to talk about it, trying to turn it into news. You're right, but there is still a little chink.
Yes, there are chinks of
real
news.
Stories, yes. Occasionally. I'm afraid it doesn't just have to be the IRA. You know, there are other potentials there. But as a journalist, you can tell this is real news, this is manufactured PR. Mm.
Yeah, but there's always that roll around in news that I find, and information that comes out, whether it be on the internet or on the television or on the radio. It's the same stories, just different variations of the housing bubble, the tax, the income for the country, the GDP.
Can I tell you about a story, I think, which was an interesting one? That was the G4S at the Olympics story.
Yes.
Now, all of a sudden, we had a massive scandal, didn't we? Two weeks before the Olympics started. I don't know about you as a news person, but when I saw that, especially because I'd had a little bit to do with it, we got a whistleblower in to G4S who did a viral 250,000 hits on YouTube, that interview got in the weeks running up to it. Mm. But it was fascinating to watch how that story was managed, because it was a genuine leak, Roger Cook style, you know, the old Cook Report style, a leak from a whistleblower. But the establishment made sure that they sorted it out, right, in the two or so weeks between when we did that interview and when it came out.
Well,
it was a major news story.
They had to, otherwise...
What would happen if that story had come out without it being all sorted by the army and all sorted by...
Just recap that story for those listening abroad.
Well, this is in the run-up to the 2012 Olympics in London. These private security contractors, G4S, who also do a lot of work for the Israeli army, for example, they are not really necessarily honest with what they are capable of, rather like Serco. A lot of these security companies, they lie, basically, when they're getting government contracts.
Well, it's like the story now of trying to get 6,000 people to join the army. They said, yes, we can do it by this date, no problem at all.
They get the
contract, they've got 2,000.
They take the money,
and
they don't
do it. And they've got 2,000.
Yeah. Yeah. But this is exactly what G4S had done in the run-up to the Olympics. Yeah. And we had a whistleblower, a guy called Ben Fellows, who tried to get hold of Channel 4 News and failed. They weren't really taking the story. So he phoned me in Bristol, and he came on for what was supposed to be a 15-minute live interview, telling us what was going on in G4S. Well, it ended up being a 40-minute interview because he had so much to say. We put it online, and it went just completely ballistic online. Then I started getting calls from a lot of London news people saying we want to do something about this, but nothing came out about it until the army had sat down with Seb Coe and the Olympic Committee and they'd got the army involved. So first, next thing I heard of it was an announcement, national announcement, 3,500 troops had been drafted in to take over. But that was a real story. It hadn't been managed, but it was very, I think, you know, if it hadn't
what
been
changed?
For me, it may, never,
what
have,
changed,
may never have come out.
Let's go back to this, is it worth... I mean, you use news as a form of protest.
Is G4S have totally lost their reputation, their image, their corporate image is gone. Everyone knows what G4S get up to. They make big promises they don't keep.
I've got to bring Clay into this. He probably he might not want to comment, mainly because the conversation has just come right round to something totally unprompted by me, but G4S...
Oh, yes.
Are you going to give a no comment?
I have to do a no comment on that one.
Well, I can say as much as you want. G4 effing S.
So I want to go back.
I'm not denying that there are nuggets of news every now and again. You know, whether it's a complete disaster, or whether it's something fantastic that's happened in the world. I'm not saying that news doesn't happen, but the day-to-day news from anywhere is the same stuff, just, as I said, different people, different
You should
time.
Be able to start using some old footage then, just keep recycling it.
I keep trying to sell it, but nobody wants to buy it.
So is it worth protesting? Is it worth putting
it
up
worth
a fight?
Protesting, yes. I, as an ex-military person as well, I will defend anybody's right to stand on British streets.
Is it just
streets?
Like exercising a muscle so it doesn't atrophy in a mirror? I feel really good about this protest. Does it actually do anything? Terence is saying
it makes people,
there's no point. He's thinking about giving
it. The government or whoever it is that you're protesting about certainly can't ignore it, especially if you've got the vocal ability to make yourself heard. If you are a small demonstration outside of a town hall with 20 mums and a placard, well, yeah, it'll get noticed, but it'll get quickly forgotten.
Not necessarily, though. I mean, for example, I think that the power of these protests is actually massive, really. And an example of that is the way the BBC suppressed that story
I think
previous weekend, which was the People's Assembly protest. 40,000 people turned up in London. A march started just outside the BBC for very obvious reasons. The BBC completely ignored it until there was loads of pressure on
the BBC.
Was it just
the BBC, though, in their defence?
No, there were a lot of other national outlets.
I remember seeing stuff in The Guardian.
But there's protests every day. You can't wander through London without seeing a huge crowd of people. Yeah. And I think you're probably right, is that local protests can make a huge amount of difference. You know, if you're protesting to get speed limit changed, or no, we don't want this incinerator here, or something like that. But, yeah, I think can certainly have a...
This is overturning austerity, isn't it? Which is a bigger oil tanker to turn around.
But I'm saying that locally, yes, you probably can make a difference because you've got a much closer relationship with your... representatives. Doesn't always work, but you know that's life. But I think on a bigger scale, no, I don't think it can make a difference. But partly because of the voting system, but partly because anything that starts to get any real traction will be quickly taken down.
Change the decision, you change society, you change consciousness in society to make that decision more difficult to make the next time. That's the whole way democracy works.
Yes.
Is that it comes up from below.
What do protesters grow up to be?
Well. Possibly decision makers, well, possibly tramps.
All the hippies from the 60s grew up to be CEOs, so, you know, that doesn't seem to... Well, I don't know. Well, they didn't change the world, so, you know, I can only assume that they, you know, bought into what the
some
man
of them, Some of them own it, if you're looking at Google and...
Yeah, but they did, I think they did, to a certain extent, change the world. They changed what was acceptable. Certainly in this country, there was a whole thing before the 60s of not... really questioning authority for particularly the monarchy. The monarchy's bubble was punctured in the 60s by programmes like That Was the Week That Was, by really, you know...
And now we don't have a monarchy.
What are you talking about? So the biggest landowners in the country, exist.
I'm using sarcasm here. So what does it matter?
Well,
I'm quite happy.
At least we can poke fun at them safely now, which we couldn't do in the 1950s, for example.
They've realised that if they let us poke fun at them, then, you know, we won't actually get angry with the fact that they've just bought an 11 million quid helicopter.
Step by step, all right? Most important thing is that the people come first, and the people's consciousness or whatever, the awareness is the most important thing.
I'm going to summarise by just acting very quickly. Protest, yes or no?
Yes.
Protest, Tony, yes or no?
Yeah.
He's a yes. Terence?
Yes, definitely yes.
You're a yes as well. I'm also a yes, mainly because if you drop two rats, was it, in a bowl of water, I can't remember, there's one that swims and fights and lives longer. And if you've been restraining and holding on to that rat and winning in a kind of squeeze fight, and then you drop that into the water, the one that's never won a fight will just give in.
But if you put 100 spiders in a box, what you will end up with is one big fat spider.
Where does that come from?
Spiders will eat each other. And you will end up with one big fat spider from 100 spiders in a box if you don't feed them.
There's a message in there somewhere.
There is. Fat spiders.
Fat spiders. I'd like to know your thoughts on this. When it comes to protesting, have you given up? Is this the ever-spreading apathy that is seems to be prevalent around the world. As you can tell, conversation as ever is 99.9% offline whilst we are here around the grave, and I felt I just had to grab a snippet of audio there. Lots of opinions. Please share your opinions if you get the chance. Go on to documentally.com and leave a comment, please, or you can even comment on the bottom of this audio if you're listening to it via audioboo.net, which will link to my profile. There's lots of other stuff there around 1984 and, of course, George Orwell's birthday, which is June the 25th every year. And we hope to be here again next year. I'm going to get back into the picnic, back into some of the other conversations that are happening on the fringe here. Thanks very much for listening. This has been a long one.